The last class of my old professor's life took place once a week in his house by a window in the study where he could watch a small hibiscus plant shed its pink leaves. The class met on Tuesdays. It began after breakfast. The subject was the meaning of life. It was taught from experience. No books were required, yet many topics were covered, including love, work, community, family, aging, forgiveness, and finally, death. The last lecture was brief, only a few words. A funeral was held in lieu of graduation. The last class of my old professor's life had only one student. I was the student.
The big internalization was the fact that the world is a dangerous place. If you make attachments to things or people, they'll be snatched away. So you better be careful. Don't put too much investment into things or people, because you're apt to lose them. That's what I internalized.
That was the voice of Maury Schwartz, the Maury of Tuesdays with Maury, and I am Mitch Albom, the author of the book Tuesdays with Maury, and we welcome you to Tuesday People, which is a podcast incarnation of a lot of the lessons learned from that book, which took place 25 years ago now. And I thought it would be a good idea to revisit the tapes, the sounds, the conversations that Maury and I had through the eyes of someone now 25 years older, hopefully 25 years wiser, but definitely 25 years older, and see how those things looked in the rearview mirror and how they look going forward in life. And that's what we do here on Tuesday People. Alongside me is Lisa Goitsch, my friend and producer. Hi, Lisa.
Hello, Mitch.
Glad to have you here as always. You always make the podcast more enjoyable, and you always come up with some great ideas for guests, and I give you full credit for our guest who's sitting right alongside you here. Hope Edelman is the author of Motherless Daughters, which was a huge number one New York Times bestseller, and really, I don't know if it began it, but certainly galvanized discussions about what it means to lose one's mother and how that affects you in your life forever. It is a profound loss. As someone who has lost his mother, I can attest to that. Maury was someone who lost his mother very young. He could certainly attest to it. And we're going to talk today about the effect that the loss of your mother has on you and how it changes you, how you can prepare for it, how you can recover from it, and many other things with Hope Edelman, who is sitting with us right alongside. Nice to have you here.
Thanks, Mitch. Good to be here.
It's a pleasure to meet you.
Same.
Your book, like mine, came out of a personal experience.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote Tuesdays with Maury to pay Maury's medical bills because he didn't have the money to cover them. And didn't realize that in writing that book, I was really sort of writing a book for myself and what it turned out to be other people could embrace too, about how to find out what's really important in life once you realize you're going to die, which many of us vaguely know but don't ever accept. You wrote Motherless Daughters because you lost your mother at mm-hmm. a very young age. 18, was it?
17.
17.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about the loneliness, for want of a better word, that I remember reading you expressed when your mother passed away, and there was sort of nothing there
Mm-mm.
in the world to sort of say, okay, this is what you have to deal with when your mom dies and
right.
you're young.
Right.
Tell
That's
us about
right.
that.
Well, my experience was almost the opposite of yours. I wrote a book for myself.
Yeah.
I wrote the book I needed that didn't exist, and I was really surprised when so many other people needed it too.
Mm.
I was 17 when my mother died of breast cancer. She'd been diagnosed about a year and a half earlier. And I went looking for a book after she died because I was a reader. And I thought maybe I can find some solidarity, you know, in pages, because I didn't know anyone else who had lost a mom. Hardly anyone. It was 1981, so there were no grief support programs.
Right.
There wasn't even hospice in my community yet. She died in a hospital, and it was pretty traumatic,
right.
her last few days. So I needed some support, and all the books I could find seemed to assume that you'd be in your 40s or 50s when your mother died, because demographically, statistically, that was
right.
more common,
right?
It was almost as if there was no recognition at all that you could be under the age of 40 when your mother died. Mm-hmm. So I kept every few years looking for that book at university libraries, at bookstores. And then I got to graduate school in around 1990-ish and decided to write it myself because I was at that point had reached like maximum frustration load, mm-hmm. not being able to find that information. And at the time, though I didn't know it, this book came out right around the time that there was a big shift happening in the bereavement community away from the five stages of grief, Kubler-Ross's work, right. which had permeated my family's experience in 1981, to what's known as the continuing bonds theory, which is about finding ways to stay connected to the loved ones who died, which is what your work has done yeah. for Maury, you know, is to maintain this ongoing connection and relationship that you share with others.
Right.
But I didn't know it at the time. I was just writing a book to help me and to meet other women who had right. lost their moms.
Right. And in that process, you went out and interviewed close to 100 mm-hmm. women, I believe, who mm-hmm. had lost their mothers at various stages of life.
That's right.
So you found that that had something to do with it. And even in the workshops that you operate now mm-hmm. to help people, you break them mm-hmm. down by age. So we're going to talk about that a little later on, about the age in which you lose your mother. But explain to our audience what is profound and unique about the breaking of the mother, well, either mother-child
right.
relationship, or if you feel it's specific to mother-daughter, then do it that way.
Well, I think mother-child is an irreplaceable relationship. You can only have, you know, one mother right. who gave birth to you, or one mother who, you know, raised you to a, if you made it all the way through childhood with right. the same mom. But the loss for a son is no less profound. It's just different.
Yeah.
But age at time of loss really is an important determining factor of the long-term outcome, very much so. And it's an irreplaceable loss. And I think, you know, a lot of people will go out looking to replace what they lost. It's often a fruitless search. We often look for it in our romantic relationships. Sometimes we're looking for it in our relationships with our children. But I've found that once we accept that we've lost something that's irreplaceable, but we can find ways to still maintain a connection to that person after they die, there's a kind of relief, you know. And when we talk about this at a retreat, I lead 4-day retreats for motherless daughters. There's this kind of palpable relief in the room, like, oh, okay, that's really sad and terrible that I can't replace that type of love. But now I can, there's relief because now I can stop searching for it in somebody else mm-hmm. and see what I can still hold on to or reconnect with even after she's gone. Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PI, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know,
trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to. Podcasts on?
Yeah, podcast, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus? Watching on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
So let's do it the way that you have found it to be most effective. Then let's start with losing your mother young. Mm-hmm. There's a interesting parallel with that with Maury. And here we're yes. going to hear Maury talking about losing his mother because she died when he was very young, just a boy. Listen to this.
My mother died when I was 8. She's been sick for quite a few years. And she was sick for about 2 years before she died. So the whole thing started at age 6, the lack of mothering, so to speak. And that's a devastating thing for a youngster. She was in her 20s. She may have been 26, but she got sick and died at 28, or maybe a little older.
What do you actually remember of your mother's actual death? Was there a day or a period? Or?
My mother went to the hospital. We did not visit her there. We got a telegram. I don't know how much later, announcing that she was dead. That's how.
That's it?
I have the telegram.
You still have it?
I showed you.
What made you keep the telegram all these years?
My father kept it. When he died, I just got some of his stuff.
How did he inform you? Were you there when the telegram came?
I probably informed him, because he couldn't read English. So, I started to cry a lot. It's usually out of deep feeling, but out of sadness, mostly the pain of having lost my mother.
Now, I have to tell you, when Maury spoke about his mother, which he did frequently, he would tear up.
Mm-hmm.
He was 78. It was literally, you know, about 7 decades later.
Mm-hmm.
And he was still crying about that loss.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us, when you lose your mother as a child, or mm-hmm. even you were 17, I still consider that a child.
It is.
It's pretty close.
Mm-hmm.
What is unique about that loss, and how does it affect most people in terms of what they start searching for, grieving mm-hmm. for, missing, mm-hmm. And reaching for as they age?
Well, when you're a child, you're still very dependent on that parent, mm-hmm. certainly the mother, to help you through your various stages of development. You can almost pinpoint what might have gotten scrambled or stuck in your development based on how old you were when your mom died. If you're very young, you may not have learned emotional self-regulation. Now, that's not to say that every living mother can teach her child emotional
right.
self-regulation. Right. We have to I'm talking about mothers who can do it themselves and can model it for their children. But this is why the surviving caregiver matters so much. In fact, it's the most important intervening variable for a child's long-term outcome is who takes care of them, how functional they are themselves, mm-hmm. and how well they can help the child navigate that loss. Maury, I'm going to guess, lost his mother in, what would it be, the 30s, the 40s?
30, yeah.
Oh, so that was back in an era when the culture still believed that children didn't mourn. So it's very unlikely that he would have gotten emotional support around that loss.
That's right.
I often work with women in their 60s, 70s, even 80s, who lost mothers in that era, who are still grieving. And I don't want to say still grieving is not the right term, because when we see a 78-year-old man tearing up because his mom died when he was 8 and he's, you know, recounting some of what he went through, I think it's a perfectly normal response because he's feeling empathy for that child that didn't get what he needed. And he's also probably identifying with the mother who didn't get a long life now that, you know, he knows what it is to have a long, full, and rich life.
What does the loss of a parent at that young stage due to that child and then eventually that adult's view of death?
Well, that's a good question. There's so many intervening variables, but a worldview will change what's called the schema. I mean, suddenly you learn at a very young age that the world is not necessarily a fair place. It's not especially if you saw someone suffer or witnessed an accident. It tells you that people you love can be taken from you,
mm-hmm.
right? Whether it's quickly or, you know, as a result of a prolonged illness. But you know things that kids your age may not know yet. And that sets you apart from your peers. And it also makes you feel different at a time when you may want to feel just like everybody else. That's a big issue for teenagers, but certainly for younger children as well. I do think, though, that it forces us to have an existential crisis at a really young age and struggle, you know, internally to develop a cosmology that can incorporate this new information.
Right.
And that can actually, you know, on one hand, be really difficult for a child to navigate on their own, again, if they don't have a surviving caregiver to help them. But it also can create intellectual leaps for a child because now they have to try to think and manage this world that others their age aren't quite understanding yet.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, I've seen this on both sides. We adopted a little girl who had lost her mother, a Haitian orphan who had lost her mother when she was 2.5 and didn't really – she claimed to have memories of her but really didn't. She couldn't recognize her mother, whatever, and would say things like, will I ever see my mommy again?
Mm-hmm.
And we would say, well, yes, you'll see her. When you go to heaven, you'll see her. And then she would say, well, how will she know me? And, you know, we'd say, well, a mommy always knows her daughter. Mm-hmm. And then she said, well, how will I know her? And is she brown like me, you know, and questions like that, you know, that you realize she was only 5 and 6 asking these questions.
Yeah.
And, you know, to have to, like you say, an existential crisis, that's a little young to be right. going through all that. But to have
yes,
to think about,
it?
You know, or what I found fascinating about it was she still so embraced the idea of having a mother. Even though she couldn't really remember any actual memories,
mm-hmm.
she made up some that yeah. we later found she was projecting onto other people. My mommy took me for ice cream. Well, my mother never took her for ice cream. There was no ice cream, whatever, but maybe she went for ice cream with somebody when she was later mm-hmm. and she put that on. But the desire to have that relationship still with her mother, mm-hmm. to look forward to it even when she, you know,
mm-hmm.
I mean, she was a child and she was talking about seeing
right.
her when she was in heaven. So clearly it's in your mind, and you said something that I think our audience is be very interested in. The other person or whoever is left behind to raise her. In her case, she had nobody. We did our best to become her. First, she came to the orphanage that I operate, and then ultimately when we brought her to live with us, we became, you know, the de facto parents, although we never, never said to her, call us mommy or daddy or anything like that. We always said, you had a mommy. You don't need to call us mommy. You just call us Mr. Mitch or Ms. Janine. So we became the next factor for her. What is, like, let's say it's a father, all right, who survives.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the mother dies, the father dies.
Mm-hmm.
What is the optimal circumstance
mm-hmm.
to
mm-hmm.
help a child get through the loss of a mother? Is it, how does a father behave? Is it good for the father to remarry or bring a mother figure in? Tell us about that.
Yeah, and that starts getting into the difference between how men and women grieve.
Right. Mm-hmm.
The Harvard Child Bereavement Study found that the kids who had the hardest time adjusting over the long term were the girls who lost a mother. And it wasn't because mother loss is much harder on girls. It's because they were raised by fathers who grieve very differently than girls. Men, and this is not completely binary, but
right.
men tend to work through their grief through action and problem solving, which can involve dating, getting involved with someone very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas females, or the traditional feminine approach to grief,
right.
I should say,
right.
tends to be talking through your emotions, reaching out to other people, self-expression. Mm-hmm. And so there's a disconnect there, right? If the girl mm-hmm. needs someone to talk to and process her emotions with, and the dad is getting involved in work or, you know, with dating, because that's how he's working through his grief. Because let's not forget, he lost
right.
a spouse,
lost his
right?
Yeah.
right?
Yeah, exactly. Whereas if a child is left with a mother, because the father dies, the mother is typically more attuned to the child's emotional needs.
Mm.
So that's, you know, that creates, like I said, a bit of a disconnect.
So
the optimal situation is to be able to, you know, process emotions with your child. And if you can't, again, because you're grieving, to find a local bereavement center with groups for kids. They're all over the country. There's hundreds of them in almost every major city in America, and a lot of smaller cities too,
right.
where that child can meet other kids who've lost a parent, or have someone to talk to. That's optimal. Dads sometimes come to me and say, my wife recently died and I'm raising 2 daughters, and what suggestions do you have for me? And the main suggestion that I have isn't always what they want to hear, but I'll say it anyway, because it is what's best for their girls, which is try to wait at least a year before you get deeply involved with somebody else or bring another woman mm-hmm. into the house,
because
your child needs to go through that year, the first birthday without her mom, the first holiday season
right.
without her mom, the anniversary of her mother's death, with you there by her side and not connected to another woman yet. And it will be an easier transition than if and when you do start dating.
Ladies and gentlemen.
What are you doing?
What do you mean?
I'm making Just keep it simple.
I'm making the promo.
Just keep it simple. Just say, hey, we're the Brav Bros. 2 guys that talk about Bravo.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, we're the Brav Bros.
No.
Oh.
Dude. Stop with the voice. Just keep it simple.
I've seen promos on TV, dude. This is how you get the fans engaged. This is how you get listeners. We're trying to get listeners here. If we just say, oh, we're 2 dudes that talk about Bravo, people are going to get tired of it already. We need some oomph.
All right, then fine. Let's try to do it with your voice.
Brav Bros.
Good job.
How does the surviving husband, father, what's the roadmap for him to provide what the missing mother used to provide versus not trying to be the mom and therefore maybe frustrating the kid.
Well, you know, just trying and having your child know that you're trying goes a long way, right? I mean, maybe you're not going to be able to brush her hair exactly like her mom did, but you're going to try. You'll figure it out together. That helps an awful lot. And also bringing in other women to fill the gap, because there's going to be something, like you said, that a dad just can't do for a daughter. The same way that there are things that a mom just can't do for a son. She can't model the kind of male behavior or male attention that he would get from his dad.
Right.
So even relatives and stuff.
Look out into the family. But what's really, really important, that's really important, is allow the child to remain connected to the mother's family.
Yes.
If it's a functional family, if it's a loving family, because she will need that connection to her mom, to her mom's stories. She needs to be around people who can tell her later in life who her mom was when she was a child and a young adult. And
so this raises a very interesting point, and we'll return to it as they get older as well. But now we're talking, you know, we're breaking it down for purposes of our podcast. So we'll break it down into sort of categories, child being, you know, 18 and under, referencing. How important is it to for that child to not only be told, okay, well, we have to get over it, you know, our mom's gone, we need to move on, you know, you hear those kinds of things. I'm guessing, because of your orientation and what you said at the beginning, that it's actually healthier to embrace a lot of your mother's memories, find out more about your mom. You know, frequently you'll see kids who'll say, I want to know everything about my mother, stuff that they wouldn't have wanted to know if their mom was alive. You know, it'd be like, oh, mom, that's a boring story. But now suddenly it's fascinating. They want to know everything.
Yeah.
What's the balance? What's the correct way to do that?
Well, I want to say, I think those cultural messages about getting over it and moving on are incredibly damaging to anyone, in Western culture, but certainly to a child. And here's why. Because a child is only capable of grieving to the cognitive and emotional state of maturity that they've achieved at the time.
Right.
So if you're Maury and you're 8 years old, you can only process that loss and understand it based on your 8-year-old cognition and your 8-year-old emotional maturity. And it's really, really predictable for children to reach certain points in their own development where they either suddenly, you know, understand abstract thinking. And they, you know, an 8-year-old is not really thinking, my mom's not going to be there when I get married.
Right.
Right? They're thinking, my mom's not going to be there when I get home from school tomorrow.
Right. Right.
They're very much in the present. So as a child develops intellectually and emotionally, they're going to revisit that loss in a different way. And the adults around them don't always connect the dots, right? Like an 8-year-old might be graduating from high school and suddenly really feel sad because their mom died 10 years ago. And when everyone thinks that they should be over it, they're not going to get the kind of support that they need. This is what I call the long arc of grief. And it's what makes it a lifelong process. Because, you know, by the way, it's really common to feel that way when you get married, when you have your first child. And my mom died when I was 17. My first child was born when I was 33. And I had a big grief response being a mother without my mother there. And it was 16 years later, right? The culture said I should have been over it by then. But, you know, heck no. I was not over it.
How about the amount of grief, visible grief, that the surviving spouse should show in front of the child?
Well, I think sometimes it's really healthy for children to see that the parents cry when they're sad, because it gives them permission to cry when they're sad. But if they feel that the parent is incapacitated or debilitated to a point where they can't care for the child, that's frightening for a child. They will often suppress their grief until the parent looks like they're doing better.
Maury went through that with his father, who really just never spoke about it.
That was very common in that era.
Sure.
1981, we never talked about my mom after she died. Can you imagine? 1981.
Yeah, that's
17
crazy.
Years of my life she had spent with me, and I couldn't talk about her because it would destabilize the other family members. Mm-hmm. I mean, my siblings and I talk about her all the time now, but we were very, very careful about not upsetting our father, because if he fell apart, who would be there to take care of us?
All right, let's shift to a second stage where, let's call it, you know, post-school, young womanhood, early marriage, perhaps first children, you know, a 20 to 40 range, when you're, you know, making your big early life decisions. If you were to lose your mother during that period of time, what have you found from the people that you've worked with, that how that hits them during that key moment of, you know, so many steps that you now, well, becoming a mother is one of them, but getting married and becoming a mother, you know, starting your career or whatever, all those things. Walk us through that.
Well, thank you for asking about that, because losing a mom in your 20s and early 30s is a particularly overlooked demographic in the bereavement world, because the idea is you're an adult, but and so you should be able to handle it. But that you may not have a lot of peers or a partner yet that, you know, really you can really share with and open up with, or who understand what you're going through. And that's a time, especially in America, the 20s is a time when you're still testing out different identities and figuring out who you're going to be and choosing your, maybe choosing your partner or choosing not to partner during that time. And you may still be very emotionally tied to your family. You've got one foot in and one foot out. And you may still be pretty dependent on your parents for advice or support or financial support these days. And so the loss of a mother, certainly during that time, if you're a woman, but even if you're a man, it can be very, very destabilizing. And you have, however, ideally, resources that to get for yourself that you can't when you're a child. You can't, when you're a child, drive yourself to a grief group, right? Or figure out your insurance so you can see a therapist. So it's a little different in that way. But the transitions into a permanent partnership, or, you know, stable partnership like a marriage or a partnering, and the transition to parenthood is really significant, specifically for women who lose their mothers and men who lose their fathers, right? Because they're stepping into that role. They want the parent to witness them. They want the parent to validate them. If you're becoming a parent, you might wish your parent were there to help you, either practically or support you emotionally.
Does there tend to be a rush in one direction or the other when someone loses their mother, to like get married quickly or start a family quickly, make substitute the some kind of familial type of thing?
It can be. It really depends on the individual. I've met quite a few women who chose to marry a man that they were with at the time their mom died, because they wanted to marry someone who their mom had known or approved of. It wasn't always the right choice for them. That was a pretty common, you know, situation that I encountered.
Marry them because they helped them get through the grief.
It creates a kind of bonding.
And they knew them at that period.
Whereas they might not have chosen them for partnership or marriage under other circumstances.
Interesting. And how about in terms of acting out? Because as you say, well, you have the resources to drive yourself to a bereavement group. You also have the resources to, you know, and money, and you're earning and you're working, and, you know, maybe
ideally,
just decide to just go way off the road that your mother might have wanted you to stay on. Maybe you feel like you've lost your North Star, you've lost your guiding light, you know, of advice. And you find people make some bad life decisions, you know?
Sure, all the time. I also find that some people find it freeing. Too.
Depends I mean, on the mom, I
went, I certainly went off the track that my mother would have chosen for me. And it led me, I think, to a much richer and more expansive life than I might have chosen for myself otherwise. So it can go both ways. You know, it can go in that direction, or it can go towards self-medicating, right? I mean, and everything in between.
What are the salves at that age? I mean, we've talked about young kids, they are at those ages, they need others to comfort them. You can't expect an 11-year-old to just sort of work it out, you know. So they need their fathers, their aunts, uncles, the people around them, teachers, you know, counselors. When you're in your 20s, 30s, you know, approaching 40, and you lose your mother, what have you found provides the most comfort for people in those ages?
It's finding others who have a similar story, which is why I've started these groups and retreats. They're all over the world now. There's more than 60 motherless daughters support groups where women get together and they feel like I found my tribe. I found the people who understand me. They share some of the same history. They share the same fears, the same challenges, the same triumphs, and we will witness each other. Every retreat that I lead is about between 20 and 26 women at a time. And they have a Facebook page where they can introduce themselves in advance and start getting to know each other. But then after the retreat, they can still meet there. And I see the Facebook pages and the posts. It's like, it's the anniversary, you know, it's the 30th anniversary of my mom's death. I'm feeling really sad. Could use some sisterly love. And, you know, within 12 hours, they'll get 17 women supporting them. Or they might say, you know, my wedding is next week and, you know, a lot's coming up for me. And they'll say, you go, you got this. Or they'll attend each other's weddings. One woman came to a workshop. She'd been to a retreat. And she said, I was standing there in my gown in the bridal room thinking, how am I going to go through this without my mom? And then two women from my retreat got there and came in the room, and I felt, okay, I can do this.
So the support of other people.
I know, I'm crying while I'm saying it.
Yeah. The support of other people in those circumstances is of the utmost comfort, you're saying.
That's what I found is the age. Is the greatest.
And
yeah,
when
support.
when they are together at these retreats, what do you find is the most common topics of conversation when they first begin to, like, the walls begin to come down? What are they saying to one another that is uniform?
Okay. Oh, that's good. That's a good question. How do I do it without invading privacy and giving examples?
Well, don't use names.
I won't do that. I think that, you know, I see when they get there, I'll tell you about this. When they get there, one of the things we do at the retreats is a one-word check-in. We go around the circle. Everyone gives us one word to describe how they're feeling. And that very first time we do it, the first night, you know, when we all gather before dinner, we hear a lot of scared, apprehensive, nervous, because they may not have opened up and talked about this with it, certainly not with a group of strangers, but sometimes not ever if they were very young and were told they had to, you know, not cry. I mean, children are have been prohibited from crying after a mother dies more often than any of us would like to think. Yeah. And then so we start on a Thursday evening and we end on a Sunday afternoon. And when we do that last check-in on Sundays, we go around the circle and the word is, I feel held. I feel comforted. I feel understood. I feel calm. I feel, you know, sad about leaving. And you can, but you see it not just in their language, but in their bodies, in their faces, you know, the release that just from being able to share their story with people who don't pity them, who don't judge them, who will receive it with compassion and curiosity. So that's the arc that we watch them travel. You know, on Fridays are a very intense day because we say we are opening up the box. You know, we're going to see what's been in there. And it's very emotional. And, you know, there's lots of tissues used on a Friday. And, you know, sometimes my co-facilitator and I on a Friday are like, whoa, forgot about how intense this is. Yeah. And if someone's leading with me for the first time, they're like, oh my God, I wasn't prepared for that. Then I say, but wait till Sunday. I promise when you see them on Sunday, it's like a blossoming. It's a whole new group. And it always is. I mean, we've done 13 retreats so far and I haven't been proven wrong with that one yet. But
okay. Now, you've talked about some of the emotional releases that people have and the commonalities they have with other people. What do you find? And let's start at that stage that we're still talking about, that 20 to 40 year old age, because, you know, they've had an adult relationship with their mother. What do women most commonly get stuck on after the death of their mother? What is it? What is a frequent tripping?
Yeah, that's a good question. I lead online courses and my next one is going to be getting unstuck because I've identified 12 areas where women tend to get most stuck in their development or in their grief. And so I'm trying to think between 20 and 40, it's often about staying, finding ways, meaningful ways to stay connected to the mother. How old were you when your mom died, Mitch?
Oh, she died about 7 years ago. So
you were in adulthood. Yeah, you were in adulthood.
Way into adulthood. You consider me in adulthood now. Yeah, no, I was in my 50s.
So how do you stay connected to her now? Like, are there ways that you continue to honor her or things that you do to celebrate her or, you know?
I've written about her. You know, there are anniversaries, their wedding anniversary, because both my parents are gone, her birthday. I was fortunate enough to make a video with both my parents, but my mom was the talker of the two of them. So she, you know, was really her, about our family history when she was still lucid and still, you know, remembered everything. She was probably about late 70s. And it's about a 25-minute long family history with all the stories, and we had a really nutty family. I mean, they were crazy.
And she fit it all in 25 minutes?
Yeah. It's probably actually maybe longer than that. And I think the first tape is 25, and then we did another like 20 minutes after that. And my father occasionally says, no, that wasn't her. That was somebody else. And she says, oh, you don't know what you're talking about.
What a gift.
It's hysterical.
Love it.
And I will watch that. I find of all the things, all the photos, all the anything that I have, I can watch that over and over again. And because she's talking about, it's not just her, but she's talking about our entire family history, those who came before her, those who came with her, those who came after her. It's the best connection that I have, just not just to her, but also to our whole family, because she was the portal through which I I knew my family. You know, she broke down my family for me. She would, not only her side, but also my dad's side, she would tell me, okay, this uncle's crazy, this one's not, this one's good, you can't trust this one. You can be like, so everything, we were all shaded by how my mother viewed our family. So to hear her talk about the family, I find to be, it's like a blanket. You know, it's just like, okay, that's, there's my mom, and she's right there in front of me. On thank God for video, you know, thank God for little cell phones that you could film. So that's how I find, you know, my maintain my connection to her. That and quoting her like every other day, because she always had something to say.
Right, but look how lively and happy you are when you talk about it. Right? And so that's what I want for the women at the retreats. And that's what we, you know, we try to help them find ways. If they're very young, when their mom died, they're often coming in with a completely severed connection. Like they don't know how to reconnect with her. If they're in the 20 to 40 range, they're usually looking for ways to stay connected. So telling stories, sharing stories about her. And we go around the circle and on a Saturday night, and we say, tell us a story about your mom. They bring pictures. They tell us stories about her. And so suddenly the 26 women in the room become 52.
Right.
Because all those moms now there are at the retreat with us.
That's great.
And we look for ways that, you know, to help them keep those memories alive and stay connected to them. And the women who don't know much about their moms, we encourage them to make a list of who can you ask when you leave the retreat, who can you ask?
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
510 is declaring an emergency. There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
I'm very, very influenced by the work of Michael White, who developed narrative therapy in Australia in the 1980s. And he wrote a paper called Saying Hello Again, because he was getting clients coming to him who were in real states of distress. They were bereaved people who were very, very well versed in the five stages of grief and felt that they were failing because they were still grieving, you know, after a period of time. And he realized that actually what was hurting them was this idea that they had to say goodbye. He thought maybe they need to say hello again. And he found ways to, and so this relational theory of grief now that helps people stay connected. The work of Lorraine Hedke is brilliant in this area, and narrative therapy. It's helping people reconnect with those who died because they find their salve in maintaining some kind of connection. That's the theory of continuing bonds as well.
It's funny because when you say that, I mean, that's exactly how I feel with that video that I'm describing.
Exactly.
And I never think like,
perfect example.
Come on, Mitch, how many times are you going to watch this?
No, this is
you know, I miss my mom. I want to hear her voice and you know, let's hear it.
It brings her into the room again, doesn't it? Yeah.
It does.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And stories, like you were saying, stories from other relatives and stuff. And like my mom's girlfriends are, you know, they're all in their late 80s and 90s now. But I love hearing their funny stories, you know, especially about when your mom was younger, things that you may not have known about her in her teenage years, or what was she like when she was 20.
Exactly.
You know, when you don't have them to ask those questions of anymore.
Right. You know, about a year and a half ago, a really good friend of mine died, and I walked as far as I could with her, you know, before friends could no longer continue walking with her. And one of the things we did was I said to her, who are your story keepers? Let's make a list. Who can your daughter come to in the future who can tell her stories about who you were as a child, about who you were in high school, about who you were in college? And we made the list and gave it to her husband so that her daughter can access those people when she wants those stories. And
precious.
You have to, you know, as a dying woman, be willing to face that you're dying, which she did, you know, really amazingly. But I really encourage people to do that for each other. That's a great gift that you can help your friend leave behind for their child if they're sick or dying.
Yeah.
So let's go now to the final sort of age group, that being when death occurs at a more normal, you know, statistical age, mothers dying in the 70s or 80s, therefore their daughters maybe being in their 40s or 50s. And there's a lot of, you know, with the baby boomer generation, there's a lot of this going on right now. And certainly people my age, Lisa's age, know people who have lost their mothers within the last 5 to 10 years. And, you know, at this point, we're already adults. Maybe your kids are raised, you know. But what are the challenges, what are the issues when a parent dies at that stage? You would quote unquote call it more normal, but I'm sure it's never normal.
Well, it's called an on-time loss,
yes,
right?
Right.
But you've maybe lived 50 years with this person in your life. You don't know how to exist in a world without, right. That's a long time to have a relationship, right? And that person probably fills multiple roles in your life. Maybe you were taking care of them, or maybe they were your confidant, or they were the mother to your grandmother to your children, or the mother-in-law to your spouse. So, and that's why we divide the groups by age at Motherless Daughters right. Retreats, because losing a mom when you're 6 is obviously very different than losing her when you're 55.
Right.
There's, in the words of the immortal Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, there is no competition in suffering. It's not better or worse to lose a mom when you're a child, or it's not easier or harder when you're a child or an adult. I don't go there with the comparisons. It's really difficult, but it's difficult at any age, but for different reasons. Mm. So, if your mom dies when you are an adult, you may have walked her through that illness, right? So you may have some trauma around watching her deteriorate like that. Right. But you also may have to help your children adjust to that loss, right? It almost like a spouse would have to do, or surviving spouse for young children. So you have multiple roles to juggle there. And, it can feel like a lot.
I wonder if where guilt enters into these equations because the one thing about being an adult when you lose an adult, and I always say this about when I compare Tuesdays with Maury, sitting with Maury was 78 years old and I was 37, and finding Chica was sitting with a 7-year-old girl when I was 57, is that nobody expected me to save Maury, but I expected to save Chica.
Yeah.
And there's a whole difference between when you somehow feel responsible for the caretaking of the individual who you lose. So I meet a lot of people now who are in their 50s taking care of their parents, and they hit all these crossroads of, is it time to put them in a home? Is assisted living? I don't, should I search for another doctor, or should just accept it? And when the child becomes the parent to the parent, so when a daughter becomes the mother to the mother, it's difficult to know how much effort to put in, how much, and do you find women who have issues after their mother's passed, like, I should have done more?
Oh, sure. Well, with any life event or, situation we find ourselves in, there's always another choice we could have made, right?
Right.
And if whatever choice we made led to an outcome that doesn't give us joy and pleasure or some form of peace, then there's guilt maybe or regret about the choice that wasn't made.
Right.
I see this a lot among the women who were teenagers when their moms died. Often a lot of guilt for not having made their mom's life easier because they were trying to juggle the demands of adolescence which often is a pushing against your parents with the demands of having a sick mom or mourning your mom, right?
Right.
Before she dies. So yeah, guilt comes up a lot.
It's exactly that comparison that I'm thinking, yes, you're teenage. And I could see if your mother dies, you feel like, oh, man, that last year I was with my boyfriend. I was arguing with her all the time. So now that I look back on it, I was so mature. But now projecting ahead, I see a lot of women whose mothers have become burdensome in some ways to them, interfering with their life, interfering with their grandchildren, all that. And they push back on that. And then suddenly their mother's gone. And it's like,
well, they might feel relief.
They do,
but and then you feel guilt for the relief,
right?
Exactly.
Right. So how do you coach people through that type of thing?
Well, sometimes it depends on the individual, because I do one-on-one coaching. So depending on the story and the individual, we might walk through all the steps and the choices that they did make. We might say, if you knew that this choice would lead to your mother's death, would you have made it? And they say, of course not. And I say, well, then you can only make a decision based on what you know,
right?
The guilt is retrospective, because at the time, you may not have been making a choice that would have led to that outcome if you knew that was going to be the outcome. Mm-hmm. So that's one route we might take. Or we might, look at that relief and balance it. I'm always looking for ways to balance out a story, working with them through forms of narrative therapy, because we create a story to understand our lives. We all do that. I mean, we're storytellers. You know this. We create, we're storytelling animals. We're looking to make meaning, and we make meaning out of story. So we might dissect their stories and see what parts of their stories maybe aren't completely true or maybe aren't true anymore. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there is, of course, when you're losing a parent at an advanced age, or like in your case, tragically, when you're losing a child, where you have a feeling of responsibility, right? I should have done something. What could I have done to help, you know, that person? And this is often comes up a lot, you know, when there's a death by suicide. What did I miss? Right. What could I have done? How could I have intervened to stop that from happening? So there, you know, we see, I see a lot of guilt around women whose moms
and
die that way.
I imagine there's also, then this happens between fathers and sons, and it has to happen between mothers mm-hmm. and daughters, I imagine. When you bury your mother at a certain age, you realize you're next. You know, like
sure.
you are now, there goes my...
my roof.
Right. Like,
my
like
ceiling.
Lisa, you said, well, my dad's in his 90s, so yeah. how, you know, I'm not going to die because look at, I've got this many years between me and him. Mm-hmm. But when suddenly they're gone and you're the matriarch or the patriarch of your family...
You've slid over.
You know, mortality right. starts to become a very real thing.
Yes, it does.
You know, and I don't think... I ever felt as, I don't know, fearful of death. You know, I try not to use that word so much, but certainly cognizant of it.
Exposed.
Yeah, exposed to death until my parents were gone. Mm-hmm. And then it's as if the sheath just comes down. And it's like, even if you're healthy and all the rest of the stuff, you realize, okay, next in line, what makes sense, it's not going to be my kids. It's not going to be my nieces or nephews. They're looking at me saying, you're the oldest one now. You're the buffer between us and
right.
death. Do you find that to be an issue with...
Sure. At any age, you know, my ceiling was ripped off at the age of 17.
Right.
And what that did for me was tell me that, you know, we're all here with an expiration date, but we don't know what it's going to be. Because my mom certainly didn't expect to die at 42.
Did you fear dying young?
Yeah, I was going to say that,
Yes. Actually, I feared dying young from breast cancer for a long time because we tend to be afraid that we'll die the same way that our parents did. It's a form of identification. Right. So, yeah, I did. I mean, I still do. Now I fear death more about leaving my children before they're ready for me to go.
Right.
But, oh, sure. Yeah, I see that all the time. Anna Quinlan actually has talked about this quite eloquently, both in Motherless Daughters and elsewhere, about how losing her mom, I believe she was 19 when her mom died from cancer, made her feel like I have to achieve everything quickly because I don't know how much time I'm going to have. Mm-hmm. So it can create this kind of overachievement. You know, it can activate the overachieving gene if you have one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So is there anything, Hope, that anything that people can do while they are, because you generally coach and work with people who have already lost their mothers after they've lost their mother.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything while their mothers are alive at all these various stages that can help prepare to perhaps soften the blow when and if death should come, either early or even in normal time, as you call it?
Well, I don't know that I would ever recommend someone to live your life and your relationship with that person as if they're going to die, right? Because we can't control what hasn't happened yet. But I can make suggestions for what you can do now so that you will have an easier time, you know, way after, you know, in the, what I call the long arc again, or what I call the after grief, which is what my next book is about, which is collect their stories, have the conversations that you'd like to have now that you can foresee, make choices for your future self. Like what I'm going to project myself ahead, you know, 10 or 20 years, what would I have liked to have said? What would I like to have, you know, have collected? Again, it depends on whether or not your mom is actively dying and knows she's dying and is accepting that she's dying. Some conversations you can have and some you can't. But certainly if you're an adult, you can think about, okay, you know, what favor can I do for my future self? Mm-hmm. I picked this up from a friend of mine, you know, who lost someone very close to him. What favor can you do for your future self now if you can envision that person? What would I like to have in the future? Or what would I like to have said? And try to do it now. Because now's all we have, right? Really.
Do you encourage people to do an exercise along the lines of, you know, what would you say to your mom if you had another conversation with her right now?
Yeah, I work with women to write letters to their moms now who have been gone for 20 or 30 years.
Frequently, the themes that they most frequently want to say to those who are gone?
I don't read their letters. They're private, so I don't know. But I think when I would sit down to write a letter to my mom or to my father, who died when I was 40, I find that I ask them for advice, but I know the answers. That's the surprise, is that I almost always, like, I can imagine what they would say to me. And maybe I'm way off, because I'm imagining what my mom would have said to me at 42, right? Now she'd be in her 80s, so right. I don't know how she would have changed and grown or developed.
Right? I don't know what she would have become.
But I can pretty much imagine, you know, what she would have said to me at 42. Yeah, that's another thing, is that your mom gets stuck in your mind at a certain age. Mm-hmm. That's another way that people feel stuck. Yeah.
I wonder how many people would want to say, I'm sorry. It seems that I'm sorry is a very common thing people want to tell their parents. And it's amusing sometimes to the parents, because it's like, that's the last thing I expected from you.
Right?
I'm sorry, but kids often feel that they do.
Well, the teenagers often want to apologize for their behavior. And we talk about that. We talk about, well, what was your mom's relationship like with her mom? And she says, well, you know, it wasn't so good for a while, and then it got better. And I said, well, don't you think your mom knew, you know, that you were just acting like a normal teenager because she'd been through it and been there once herself? And that often, you know, helps people self-regulate a bit there.
Well, what an interesting topic and world that you have dived into. We're dropped into, I guess, you know, by life circumstance. But as we have both found, you know, interesting exposures to death can lead to very life-affirming types of things.
Sure.
And what you do is really, really important work. If you haven't read Motherless Daughters, if you're one of the four people out there who haven't, then you should get it. And there are a number of other books that Hope Edelman has written as well, Letters from Motherless Daughters and others, and now a new one that you've got coming out.
The After Grief.
And also, you mentioned that you're considering or doing going back to the original almost 100 people that you interviewed for Motherless Daughters and kind of find out where they are now, which is sort of in line with what we're doing with this podcast 25 years after Maury and I had these discussions. So I think you'll find that to be very interesting.
I have so far. I've found 17 of the original women from Motherless Daughters, re-interviewed them. And what's fascinating is to see how, you know, because the facts of a death don't change, right? Like my mom will always have died in 1981.
Only the perspective.
Exactly. I was 17. She was 42. Those facts are fixed. But the way that we interpret those facts and the way that they guide us changes so much over time. That's been fascinating to witness.
Yeah. Look forward to that. Come back and talk to us when you're
ready.
I'll be
happy to.
For sure.
I'd love to have you back. We hope you enjoyed this edition of Tuesday People, the podcast. We do this once a week. And so on behalf of Lisa Goitsch and our guest Hope Edelman, again, Motherless Daughters is her original book, and there are many others since then. Thank you for sitting in with us on this conversation, and we will see you next Tuesday.
Thank you for listening to Tuesday People. To be part of our conversation, join the Tuesday People community at wetuesdaypeople.com. Subscribe to our podcast so you don't miss an episode, and share it with your friends. We look forward to having you with us every Tuesday because, after all, we're Tuesday People.